listening to Funding Rural. I'm Erin Borla with the Roundhouse Foundation. I'm also a fellow with the National Center for Family Philanthropy. Today, I want to introduce you to Cece Gardner-Glaser. She's one of my fellows with NCFP and someone I have really enjoyed getting to know. Cece's an advocate for social impact and racial justice work. She serves on the boards of several family foundations and has worked in philanthropy for over a decade now. I really appreciated Cece opening up about being a woman of color, traveling in these philanthropic circles. I think it's important to recognize how our experiences impact how we show up as funders. I wanted to have Cece on the show because when we talk about the challenges and missed opportunities in rural philanthropy, she and I often comment on how her work with inner city communities of color and our rural work resemble each other, but we'll get into that. As always, stick around after our conversation and I'll share some of my key takeaways. And you can also check out show notes and more reading at fundingrural.com.
I work in philanthropy, and the way I came to it was just I worked in nonprofits, and I on the nonprofit side, I always helped with writing the grants for the organization I worked at. And I would see, you know, the grants we would get or the grants we wouldn't get. And then I spent some time on a couple of participatory grant making committees. And it was really interesting once I got on that side of it to make decisions about grants, and I saw who was at the table. And folks were making decisions about communities they had not spent time in, didn't really have a connection to. And I thought, oh my gosh, I have to get to the other side of this. And then I just started looking for jobs over there. And it's been, it's just been eye-opening. And at the end of the day, I think when you just kind of peel everything back, philanthropy, the literal translation is just love of people. And I just think, I mean, if we showed up with that in the work, but not just in the work, but in everything else we do, I feel like we can get a lot of stuff done.
I love that. So the podcast that we're doing talks about rural philanthropy, and I'm so thrilled to be able to talk to you because I think when we've chatted over the past several months, there's these through lines that we see in philanthropy, regardless of community. And I think it's really critical that we talk about that. So I wanted to touch on the comment that you said about making decisions about communities that they haven't spent any time in. And I just think I want to dig into that just briefly, because that's something that we've heard throughout all the different episodes that I've done here of like, just show up, just be present for a minute. So tell me a little bit about your experience with that.
Yes. So I was seeing this kind of over and over, where there was this idea where folks would use maybe an article or something they read as the evidence and how they should proceed in the grant making. And I remember, and I was sitting there, and one particular instance I will never forget is we were making, it was with the Women's Funding Foundation, and we were making decisions. There were these two grants, and one was to support teenage mothers, and one was I think it was to support Planned Parenthood and teenage prevention, pregnancy prevention. And everyone at the table, all women, were like, we want to give to the Planned Parenthood grant. We want to prevent the teenage pregnancy prevention. And I was wondering, you know, I get the systems change stuff, but we kind of have to do both. And direct services involved. And so I really kept asking, but why don't we want to support this other organization? And they were like, oh, we'd rather do, you know, something bigger. And I said, well, do you know any teen parents or in? And they're like, well, no, but we know that this, we just need to stop it, you know, before it starts. And I was like, well, raise your hand if there are anyone at the table that had their kids as a teen. So I raised my hand and I was like, oh, just me. Okay, so can I share? I was like, it's really strange that you are making decisions. And then they were telling me about, well, this article says this or this one. And I was like, but I'm a real whole person and I've actually mm-hmm. lived it. So why aren't our voices at the table? And, you know, and then from there, I really started to key in on that, where folks were using, they were using everything, all of this information they were getting from wherever. But then when I would ask, well, have you been there? Have you even just talked to folks in that community to ask them what they need? And they were like, no. And it was almost like, I didn't know what, like, that's not how you do the work. So it was a little bit like, I didn't know what I was talking about. And like, we have the best of the best people that wrote these white papers for us, and we trust them. And it was, I really just couldn't understand why folks were just unwilling to show up in communities and not to come in and like take a community over, or, you know, and not to be weird with the kind of voyeurism that happens too, yeah. But to just come in and learn and just get to know real people and the real stories of why the work matters. And then, you know, because I think once you can feel it in your body and you've connected with it in a real way, it changes how you do the work. You're no longer maybe showing up in it with the charity mindset or the savior piece. Like, well, we just have to do this because these people don't know, or, you know, just that kind of feeling. And but when, because it also, because the charity mindset, I always think, is kind of this one-sided piece. Like, you need us to help you. Let us do this for you, and then I will feel good about it. Where mm-hmm. when you show up in community, it actually changes you too, you know? So it's for everyone.
You and I got connected because we're both fellows for the National Center for Family Philanthropy. So tell me about your journey sort of getting into that space and what you're working on with your fellowship project.
Yeah. So the work I'm doing for my project is to work with wealth holders that are doing the work of relational reparations, where there's a couple of pods where folks are building these really deep, strong relationships, so some of them, it's like white women and Black women, and they're talking about, the white women are the wealth holders, and they're talking about where their money came from, which in a lot of communities, I think particularly wealthy ones, we don't talk about money. Well, I don't know why I said we, because I'm a regular person, but, and it wasn't until I was around like people with wealth that I know for them, I was kind of maybe off-putting, because I always talked about money. I'm like, oh my gosh, my light bill is $400. What the hell? Or these groceries, how am I going to afford groceries, a mortgage, and gas in the same month? Or, you know, but it was, and I think in my family, we always talked about money. I mean, and we would name it. It was just regular part of the conversation. Like if someone says, oh my gosh, I love your dress, I'm like, thank you, it's $14, I got it at such and such. and I didn't know that was different until I was around wealthy folks, and no one ever talked about money. And so I was like, oh my god. And then when I would want to talk about, well, where did your wealth come from, and they're like, well, you know, my family worked really hard. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure my grandfather worked pretty hard too, you know? So, and I knew his story of how they bought their first home, and I'm just like, I want to know more. And to them, to many of the folks I was working with, were like, no one, we don't talk about money. Like, it's just not what we do. And I was like, but that's the thing that's going to change everything. Let's talk about like where your wealth came from. And people would say, well, it doesn't, cause especially as I started getting deeper into the reparative action work, and oftentimes folks wouldn't make the connection around like the institutional racism, systemic racism, the attempted genocide of Indigenous folks and stolen land, and, you know, and then the free labor, you know, like the country was built on the backs of Black bodies. And I'm like, no one gets any of the wealth without those things happening. And it was just, people were like, oh my gosh. they're like, well, we had nothing to do with slavery. We had no, you know, and I'm like, no, it's not at an individual level, but let's talk about like, if your wealth comes from your grandfather, what were the things that he was able to move through that maybe my grandfather couldn't move through to be able to like start a business or get a loan or, you know, like, I mean, I was like, when you're in a country that literally had laws saying that Black folks couldn't live in this neighborhood, or banks redlining and not giving loans, or the GI Bill only benefited some people. Like, we have to talk about those things because we don't get here without it. It's never as simple as like, this person was a hard worker and this person isn't. The bootstraps thing. So the project that I wanted to do, because now there's more people, wealth holders, that are willing to talk about their wealth and where it came from, is to really start modeling that. And NCFP, I saw, is actually starting to talk about that. And I think that, I mean, I feel like it's like the layers beginning to peel back. And what I've seen happening is like, once people can share their own stories and even recognize that they have their own story, it's breaking down the walls of, humanity. You know, I don't want to sound cheesy, but I really, really feel like if we can just break down those things and get to know each other, but also talk about the thing. Like, if money is the thing, we got to talk about it. And then it completely starts to shift the conversation and removing the shame and guilt that a lot of wealth holders have around, around even just having this wealth. And then people have moved to start to return it, to not just, you know, giving money to nonprofits, but to individuals. And that has just been a game changer.
That's such incredible work that you're doing. I always love chatting with you and hearing all about it, because I think you get so passionate, and hearing your passion and excitement and the way that things and conversations are happening, I just think is really, really exciting. I mean, we get questions frequently of like, well, why do you, and that's why I started this podcast, right? Is like, why do you focus on rural? Why is that important? Why are you doing that? And it's those consistent questions. And a lot, it comes back to like, oh, well, maybe why are we doing that work? And it's like traditional underinvestment in these communities. And frankly, it's like, we see that these communities haven't been heard, haven't been listened to, and haven't been respected, right? Mm. And that's, I think, the through line with the work that you have done with some of the foundations that you're working with, whether it's in an urban center or with communities of color and with communities that we're working on. And I think that's why I so badly wanted to talk with you on this, is it's an equity equation, right? And I mean, we can get uncomfortable here for a minute, right? We're friends. Yep. Let's talk about like the racial justice movement, particularly after George Floyd's murder, and how the shift that we saw in philanthropy and what that looked like as a black woman in philanthropy. And I'd love to just touch on that and where we see that now, 3.5 years later, like after the boxes have been checked. And I'd love to just touch on that if you're comfortable with it.
Yeah, definitely. And I think just as you brought that up, I could feel like in my body, like some tightening of just when you asked, like, and how was that for you? And you know, I don't even think I've really talked about it. You know, I mean, I've talked about like, has the money moved, or have people done what they said they're going to do? And then a lot of funders are pulling back, like their increased spend that they did for 3 years. They're like, okay, that's over. And I just remember when it happened, I mean, the experience that I've had, like I started at a particular foundation in 2016. And I remember there were, and we were doing some diversity, equity, and inclusion work. And I remember it was, you know, we were doing it every board meeting. And I remember someone like, oh, I thought we did this last month. And I'm like, Well, you kind of had to do it all the time, especially because I'm here and I was the first person of color hired, the fourth person on staff and the first person of color. And I think it was like exciting, like, oh, we've hired a Black woman. This is amazing. She's going to bring all of her experience. And then I think it was like, oh, wait, she's going to bring all of her experience. Like, I'm a full person. And so I'm always going to be here. I don't get to say, like, you know, we talked about the, like, 2020, we've talked about what happened. And now are we done with it? Or even being in certain philanthropy circles where folks were like, and I remember it was kind of like buildings were on fire when George Floyd was murdered. And everyone was like, oh my gosh, we got to figure out what to do. We need to give money here and we need to. And then people were reaching out to me and they're like, can you support us or we need help? And I was just like, what's the urgency? Like, that's the piece I could not understand where it was this piece of everyone wanting to move very quickly and fix the thing. But I was like, but this is the thing that's always been happening. Like, nothing has changed. What's changed is that you saw it. And it was during the pandemic. So you were at home and things were a little bit quieter. So maybe it allowed people to get in touch with something that when they would see it before, it really didn't get into their bodies. So then I think that's where they felt the urgency, like, this is terrible. We have to do something. And for me, I was just like, this is literally the life that I live. Like, I have a Black boy, and one of my achievements, my accomplishments every year is that my son is still alive. And I was just like, this is real life. And I remember there was a lot of videos and things coming out after George Floyd. And I remember trying to share something with the group I was working with. And they were like, well, we don't want to watch it. Like, I don't want to see that anymore. I want to just tell us where to send the money. And I was like, but that's the thing. Like, it's more than just you sending the money. Like, if you're not allowed, because you don't want to feel uncomfortable, because it makes you sad, you don't want to watch this video. But I was like, but I need you to, because it makes, when you say, like, you don't want to see it, you just want to send the money, and me as a Black woman with Black children, my Black father, like, it's like you're saying you don't want to see me. And I really need to be seen. I need to be seen right now. Like, I need you to slow down and sit for a second. And I want you to see, like, literally, this is what so many of us have been holding. This is real life. Like, this is real life for us every day. So even when you say to me, why do we have to do DEI stuff? Again, I'm like, I'm literally asking you to learn about something where me, my family, my communities are literally living it every day. And I'm asking you to learn about it. And, like, you have Zoom fatigue, or you don't want to, like, that I can't even get you to learn about it. I was like, do you know how painful that is? And 2020, I think so many things changed for so many people. I mean, it was really where I started looking at, what am I doing? How am I spending my time? People aren't just going to change overnight or at all. I think there was some shaming and guilt that happened in 2020. So no one wanted to be the person without the Black Lives Matter sign in their yard. You know, but it's like, but you literally have Black people in your companies, in your neighborhoods. And what are you doing to really say that you see them? Do you really see them? It can't be like a trend. And that's sometimes what it felt like. And when I left my job in 2021 to start consulting, I wanted to do work differently. And I wanted to be in a place where people, we're gonna say, you know, I know this is hard. Some of this work makes me very uncomfortable, but I still want to stick with it and I want to do it. And I'm here for the opportunities to be called in when I say the wrong thing, when I do the wrong thing. But I want to stay in this space and continue to do it. And I just didn't want to, like, I don't know. Like, I didn't want to, I think, just be a part of something that where people could see it as something they could tap in and tap out. Because this is like life. I don't have the choice to tap in or tap out, even though sometimes I want to.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing. I know that was challenging and difficult. And I do think it's important that, and it circles back to a lot of the things we talked about earlier. But I think the biggest piece is that this learning is a continuum, right? Education is not like we're going to do the training and then we did it and we can put it on our website and we can say, oh, I did that. Or, oh, I read that book. It's on social media and those things. And I think that piece is the most critical piece of, like, how do we recognize education as a continuum? And how do we hold space for people that we care about, that impact our, that we work with, that are friends, that are colleagues, but then also maybe those that we aren't as connected with, those that, like you shared, were working in the company, or the neighbor down the street. Like, how do we hold that space in a way that's authentic and allows for vulnerability?
Oh my gosh. Yes.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, we started this work and doing work across rural spaces includes reservation communities and working with our Indigenous partners. And that was the first question that I asked, was to other colleagues and partners that have done this work before. Like, how do we do this work right without screwing it up? And their answer was, buckle up, you're gonna screw it up.
Yeah.
And that's okay. And I think that's hard. That's a hard place to be, is to know that you're gonna step in it at some point and have to own that. Because I think ultimately everybody's heart's in the right place. Like, we talk a lot about giving grace to people. Like, if you say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing, it's not who you are as a human being. Like, you're able to come back from those things. So hold grace for each other. But how do we keep doing the work?
Yes. Yeah. And when you said vulnerability, it was like, ding, ding, like, that's it. How do we get folks to show up with humility and the willingness to be vulnerable? And I think for soul, because again, best practice guy or whoever somewhere said, like, this is what professional looks like, and then this is unprofessional, or, you know, and all of those things. And, like, I remember, like, I cried at work, and it is like, oh my gosh, this is so unprofessional. But I'm like, I'm a person and I can't just hold this anymore. I am, like, physically in pain right now. I'm sad. And, you know, and some part of me needs to be repaired. And I have to believe in people and humanity. And if I'm making you uncomfortable because I cried at the office, what are we doing? You know, you're asking me to leave so much of me outside of the door, be a different person when I walk in. And we're never going to get anywhere like that. And it's like, and I need to see your vulnerability too, your humanity, because then that allows me to have grace for you. And I think about the work I do in this relational reparations has been transformative for me, because I know for a while, because I didn't really have deep relationships with white people. So in my mind, I'm thinking all white people are this way, and you all have access to resources, and you all don't have any problems because you have money. And, you know, and I think particularly working with wealthy folks. And once I began to get in deep relationships, I mean, it's it's changed everything for me. Like now, like before, you know, in a workspace, if a white person, a white woman is like, well, I can't come in today because like, I'm just not feeling well. I'm like, are you serious? My people picking cotton, they never got any day. You know, I'm like, what the hell? You can't come to work today because your tummy hurt. But through this work, and I mean, the building of empathy that has happened, and knowing that I had to have spaciousness for that. And I'm like, oh my gosh, why is this my work? How did I get in this work? But it has shifted everything, because now if a white woman says to me, you know, I don't feel good today. I can actually see her as an individual and say, I see you don't feel well. You know, you should do what you need to do to take care of yourself. And now because I can see her as her own person, and I don't have that tape playing in my head of like, I've had to work all the time. I don't get to take a day off. And the ancestors did this. And like, you've had everything handed to you. Like, what's wrong with you? None of that stuff comes in. Now someone can just say, I don't feel well. And I'm like, okay. Like, I got you. What do you need? And that wouldn't have come without the building of relationships and people being vulnerable.
I remember I had a phone call with another young philanthropist, and they said, we want to do this work, and we want to be in this space and that space. We don't know how to find grant partners. And I said, get on the phone. And that was such a foreign concept of, I don't want to call people. And I mean, I was in that space when our organization grew and we knew we had additional funds to distribute. I was on the phone the last weeks of December calling, hey, I hear you're doing great work. Tell us what you're doing. And the conversation would go one of two ways. They would not say a single thing.
Right.
It was the weirdest conversation they'd ever had. Or they wouldn't stop talking for 45 minutes and tell me all the great things that their organization was doing. They'd never had a funder call them and just say, I've heard about you. Oh, tell me what you're working on. And I think that's where we can do better, whether we're working in an urban space doing social justice or racial justice work, or whether we're in a rural space doing the same work, right? Because let's talk that there is diversity in spaces that is not just in urban centers. So, but it's getting closer and having those phone calls and saying, I want to hear what you're doing. And then being open about the way that our processes work too, of like,
yes.
Hey, not everything's going to be in our wheelhouse, and that's okay, but I still want to hear about what you're doing. Sounds like you're doing great things in your community. So, and being heard, I think, is such a cool thing.
Yes.
And can break down so many barriers of like, I had the craziest thing happen. This funder called me and just said, hey, I want to hear what you're doing. It didn't amount to any funding, but man, I felt like I built a partnership or a relationship. So.
Yes. Like, how many relationships I still have with organizations where we've known each other for 4 or 5 years, and I was never able to move money to them because it just, you know, didn't align for one reason or another. But we built a real relationship where now, I mean, we talk every once in a while and we strategize together on who, you know, who are some organizations that want to fund this kind of work and such. But it's so much deeper than just the transactional piece.
Mm-hmm. I had a phone call with a gal when we first were growing, and we talked multiple times, and then our application came, and I was so excited to see what she was going to put forth, and she didn't apply. And I called her and I said, you and I have talked 3 times. I've said all these wonderful things. I think I'm pretty great. I think you're pretty great. I never saw your application. And she said, I didn't need your money. I needed the 3 introductions you made. And I'll come back to you next year when I maybe need capital or cash or something. But I didn't need that right now. And that framed my whole process of how I do this work. I mean, I've always been an inquisitive human being. Like, I asked all the questions all the time. I'm like, do you know that person? You know that maybe you're not the first one that's doing this. Like, maybe you should talk to someone else that's done it before. And you can, anyway, yeah, we can all figure it out together. But to have somebody say, I didn't need the cash, thinking that that was my value that I brought to the table, right?
Right.
As a funder. And they're like, no, I needed that introduction that you made.
Oh my
goodness. That was a big deal.
Yes. Oh my, like in one of these reparations groups I'm working with, there was someone, a Black woman that was raising money for a nonprofit she was leading. And she presented, you know, to the group, because we do these things called councils where everyone shares, like, this is what I'm working on and where I can use support. And she's like, I'm trying to raise, I don't know, $20 million or $10 million. And I remember the white women were like, oh my gosh, are you asking us for money? And she was like, did I ever, I told you about what I'm working on. And so what are the ways that you can support me in this? And then it was like, once they figured, oh, this isn't like just a fundraising ask. Mm-hmm. It was networks. And then a couple of them just held different house parties or Zoom parties because they have access to folks that we don't know any of these people. We aren't in those circles. And just through that, making those connections and introductions and hosting those events, that woman was able to raise the money for her organization. You know, and I think, and it didn't cost them anything to, I mean, social capital, they had to, you know, use their relationships and their networks, but I think it really opened the door that, oh my gosh, when people are asking for something, it is not because I'm a funder or because I'm a wealthy person, it actually, it's not always about money. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for spending some time. I know it's been so fun to get to know you over the last several months and see the different things that we're both working on. It's like, oh, but that resonates. And this works so closely with the things that we're doing here. Things that seem so disparate and so far up, especially now when we talk about the political divisiveness of our country. We are so similar.
Yes.
And the things that we fear and love and care about are so similar. If we just pause and really take a look and get to know one another beyond the social media, beyond saying, well, I did that thing and now I don't want to talk about that thing anymore. It's been so great. Thanks for spending time.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great. I just love talking to you.
I sure love talking with Cece. I think it's always just so great to hear how close we are as people and as humans and how similar we are. I think in the philanthropic world, we can acknowledge that we have more than money to offer, but we have that access. You know, Cece talked a lot about connections and networks and what happens when we open up who we know to be able to build those relationships to help one another. That's something that we're really proud of here at Roundhouse is, you know, I may not even be able to fund your project, but man, I know these other folks that are really interested in what you're doing, and I'd be happy to connect you with them. And I'd be happy to learn more. So I know if something else comes along that might be helpful to have you all connected. It's like, how do we create those additional ripples in the pond? I think it's important to acknowledge that sometimes that can be uncomfortable, and discomfort is where we grow, right? So when we learn about other folks or other folks' experience, that may make us uncomfortable, but it's okay. Being vulnerable as funders is really important. It can be very scary. Being vulnerable on your own is something that it causes pause. And I think we're supposed to be the ones as funders that have it all together. And the truth is, we don't know everything. We don't know everything about people's experience. We don't know everything about what's happening in a certain community. Or it's just important to recognize that those are our shortcomings and that we may have our own. So how do we show up authentically and open? I think it's important that we all show up together, especially our funders, outside of our comfort zone. And then thanking our allies as we're doing that work. Those guides along the way that we lean on for education that help keep us in check. We want to show up for community as our whole self. And sometimes that means we need to be knocked down a peg every once in a while. And I think that's important. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.